I invite you once again to take your Bibles and we'll turn together to 1 Corinthians, to the portion of Scripture that we read earlier. In verse 17, Paul had explained that he had been called to preach the gospel, and in such a way that the gospel would not be emptied of its power as a result of a kind of amalgamation of human speculation and divine proclamation. A reminder too, as we said in conclusion last time, that when we're tempted to dress up the gospel in the garments of modern philosophy and human speculation, the simplicity of the cross will be lost sight of in the complexity of man's ideas. And so Paul, in writing to the Corinthian believers, urges them that they make sure that that does not happen to them, as he seeks to ensure that it hasn't happened to him. Now, when we recognize this, it's not too difficult for us to understand that the enemy of our souls, who also recognizes this, delights in pulpits that sound as though they are preaching the gospel, when in actual fact, they're missing the mark. The evil one is more interested in having people stand in pulpits sounding as if what they say is true and effective, than having people there who are vehemently opposed to the truth of the gospel. Because in the vehement opposition to the gospel, people will be able to discriminate fairly quickly. The most difficult thing to deal with is to listen to discourses that use all the right phraseology, that seem at certain points to make the right kind of emphases, and yet somehow in an almost intangible way denude the message of its essential clarity and its distinctive power. Now Paul says the message of the cross is being preached. And when it is preached, those who listen are divided into two groups, supremely so. In one group are those who are being saved as a result of their faith and trust in that message which has been proclaimed. And in the other group, it comprises those who are perishing. The word for perishing means literally perishing, wasting away, but with the added connotation that the wasting process will never finally reach a conclusion. It is a perishing which will go on right into eternity, which disintegrates man at the level of his psyche, at the level of his body, in physical terms, in spiritual terms, and it will be a disintegration process which never finally comes to an end, so that there will be no quenching of the thirsty tongue. There will be no solace for the lonely heart. And the perishing element will be a ghastly thing to contend with. Now, despite the fact that men and women this morning are prepared to acknowledge that in physical terms we live in a perishing community, because we look in the mirror and we realize we just don't look as good as we did yesterday. People bring out old photograph albums and let us know that we are aging, even though we may not acknowledge it to be the case. And we know in a micro perspective that the putrefying process of life has already set in, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. Gentlemen who were once robust, and when they stood and shaved in a morning, were able to look in the mirror and see the trim nature of the wedge from their shoulders down to their waist, now discover that there are things hanging all over the place that they never saw before. When they sit up in their tub, they can manage by means of gravity to assume that all is well, but when they lie down, there's a kind of bloating sensation that they're not pleased with, but there is very little they can do about it because they are already giving the indications of a perishing body. Far more significant, says Paul, and I can't dwell on it, it's not the emphasis of our study this morning, far more significant, says Paul, is the fact that men and women, what they recognize in the physical realm is true in the spiritual realm. And unless by grace through faith the process of decay is arrested, perishing will be their ultimate destiny. And so he says, let us make sure that when we are proclaiming the gospel, that we are doing so in a way that recognizes what our priority must be. Men and women are prepared to embrace what we have to say as long as it seems eminently sensible to them. But as it was in the city of Corinth, so it is in Cleveland today, that when you distill the essence of the gospel message, the message of the cross about which we've been singing, people frankly say, that is nuts. And in the Corinthian context, with all of its wisdom, with all of its wealth, with all of its arts, with all of its Olympian athletes, with all that was on offer for the average family as they moved around the city in that first century context, the notion that this little converted Jew, with his brusque manner and his blunt message, had something to say that was worth listening to, was really just a joke to them. They had no notion that he was anything other than a figure of fun, somebody to be laughed at and to be ridiculed, rather than someone to be listened to and respected. Despite that truth, throughout the ensuing 2,000 years, the Church of Jesus Christ has scrambled for respectability. And those who have been the exponents of the truth of Jesus Christ, clergymen so-called, have scrambled for the same measure of respectability. And so it is that in the climate of our day, it is fairly comfortable and obvious that people are accorded a certain standard of acceptance, even in a degenerating spiritual context such as ours. We are a long way removed from the apostolic context whereby Paul arrived in Iconium and in Lystra and in Derbe, not going on the local news channels, not driving into town under banner headlines which read, "We welcome the mighty apostle," but rather coming in as a figure of triviality, proclaiming a message that was obscure, doing it in a way that people thought was stupid, and very often ending bloodied and beaten, lying on the outskirts of the town. And so it is that we have, in our quest for respectability, in our longing for relevance, made ourselves patently irrelevant in a world that has decided that our message is absolutely daft. Because no matter how well we marshal our apologetic arguments, no matter how good we are at trying to justify our spiritual existence to those who are intellectually erudite, the fact is, loved ones, this morning, that when we get to the very heart of it all, our neighbors and our friends simply refuse to make sense of a crucified Christ. It is, says Paul, the message of the cross, foolishness to those who are perishing. Now, this is not something new, and so he quotes from the Old Testament, from Isaiah 29, and if you have a minute, you could turn over to it and just look at it. Isaiah 29 and verse 14 is the substance of his quote. And Paul is pointing out that God's way has stood in marked contrast to man's way from all of time. And when you come back to this section in Isaiah, we don't have time to dwell on it, you will discover that it is describing a context, 8 centuries B.C., in the kingdom of Judah, where people were thinking and planning and acting in a way which effectively said, God is not a reality, and therefore God is irrelevant. And so you will notice that it was within the framework of worship that this was going on. It wasn't that these people had become totally secular. No, they were still showing up at the worship services. It wasn't that they didn't sing the hymns. They were still singing the hymns. It wasn't that they didn't pay attention to what the prophet was saying. They listened. And for all intents and purposes, if anybody were observing them simply from an external perspective, they would have said, there's a group of people who are really embracing the message. But listen to what God says. Verse 13. These people come near to me with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship is only made up of rules taught by men. There's no heart in it. They're only coming because somebody said, you've got to come. And so they obeyed, but they weren't happy. And so God says, therefore, once more, as I've done before, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. The wisdom of the wise will perish, there's your word, and the intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. I'm going to blow it away, he says. And then one of these great woe passages. Woe to those who go to great depths to hide their plans from the Lord, who do their work in darkness and think, who sees us? Who will know? Isn't that the way children think? When their parents told them, I don't want you to take any of this at all. I baked it. I'm coming back for it. I know it's there, and I expect it to be there when I come back. And then they leave. And then in the mind of a child, they begin to go through this process of thought. Well, I bet she doesn't know how many are there. She was busy. She couldn't have counted. And after all, there's no one here now. Let me just close both of these doors. No one sees. No one will know. And so apparently no one sees and no one knows. And mother comes home and she apparently doesn't see and she apparently doesn't know. And so the child is home scot-free, isn't she? Isn't he? No, because when they lie in their bed in the evening, they have a sneaking suspicion that somebody saw. Somebody saw. But they don't know who it was, and they can't quite work it out. And the guilt within their heart rises within them. They know that someone saw. God saw. And so they face that great crossroads in their lives, whereby the possibility of confession and forgiveness is there. But if they choose not to confess and not to be forgiven, then they repress their guilt. And they continue in that process. It will become a pattern of their lives. And they will continue to look for places in the darkness where they can do their deeds. Because after all, they say to themselves, who sees us? Who will know? Friday evening, I was driven through Milwaukee in a car that was on its last legs, literally. It was exploding every so often, and everybody was scared to death in the car, and its lights had gone out, and we couldn't go on the freeway, and it was just a disaster. And at one point of relative panic, as we came down this darkened place with these buildings on either side in the gloom, I said, man, what a place this is. And the gentleman in the back of the car says, yeah, he said, funnily enough, you see that there? That's Dahmer's apartment building, shrouded in the darkness. The place where Jeffrey Dahmer had said to himself, no one will see, no one will know. Just the same kind of darkness that the Mr. Businessman creates when he waits till his wife has gone to bed and takes out a video that he knows his wife wouldn't want him to have. And in the darkness watches it, because after all, who sees? Who knows? And he faces the tax situation and recognizes that he hasn't done what he ought to do, and he's going to have to find a dark place somewhere to juggle these figures. But it'll be okay, because after all, who sees? Who knows? The young couple, knowing what the Bible teaches about premarital sex, run off into the darkness some night and in a wooded area with misted up windows in the car, convince themselves, who sees? Who knows? Loved ones, that's the way man thinks. And guess what? God knows that. And he sees. And he knows. And he confounds that kind of thinking. He blows it away. He frustrates the intelligence of the intelligent, and he makes man realize his own puny mentality on things. Look at what he goes on to say. You turn things upside down as if the potter were thought to be like the clay? That's stupid. Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, he did not make me? Do you remember the first time in art class you got to do that, make a thumb pot? You weren't allowed on the wheel yet, which was really good thinking on the part of the art teacher, because when you finally got on it, he realized it was a major mistake. And you got that baby going with pressing those pedals underneath, and it was going faster than the speed of light, and clay was going everywhere off the wall. So he shouted, stop and get out. A little bit of biographical detail there, sorry, just creeping in. I remember his name, it was Mr. Lumsden. But you brought that thing home, an ugly looking piece of work, if you were honest. Your mother said it was great. She stuck a daffodil in it to try and dress it up. You remember how once you put it up on the mantel shelf, it started to call out as you ate your dinner. It started to call out, "You didn't make me, I made myself." No, it didn't, because it couldn't. That's a stupid idea, isn't it? That's a silly idea. That a pot crafted by the hand of man would stand up and say, "I made myself." That's a daft idea. Do you want to hear an even crazier idea? That modern man would stand up and thumb his nose at God and say, "Hey, I made myself. Get out of here." Can the pot say to the potter, "He knows nothing"? So Paul, quoting the Old Testament, makes it perfectly plain that God's wisdom and His way of reckoning is vastly different. And the people 2,800 years ago in Isaiah's day walked around with a smirk all over their faces, relying on human ingenuity and human resourcefulness. So what has changed, I ask you, in 2,800 years? Men and women still today are walking around with a smirk on their faces, relying on human ingenuity and human resources. Even people who are within the framework of the church. And that's the reason Paul is writing this. He's not simply talking about something that's going on outside. He's talking about a problem that's going on inside. That's why he's saying these things. You expect the world in its foolishness to act this way, but you don't expect the church to act this way, do you? You don't expect the church to rely on itself, to rely on the personalities that God has given as gifted people? You don't expect that. But you see, the way of the cross was totally misunderstood even by those who were closest to Jesus at the time. You remember the statement in Matthew where Jesus gathers the disciples around him. He says, "Now here's the deal, guys. We're going up to Jerusalem. We have to go up to Jerusalem. When I get to Jerusalem, the chief priests and the scribes are going to deal with me very badly, and I am going to be killed, crucified, and on the third day I will rise again." And what happened from there? What was the very next thing that happened? One of the three that were closest to him, Peter, James, and John, Peter remonstrated with Jesus and said to him, "God bless you, Master. Nothing like this must happen to you. I mean, Jesus, things are going good. Don't mess it up now." We've had the feeding of the 5,000, and a lot of people like that. This stuff where you walk in on the water, people are getting intrigued by this, and I'm telling you, you do this a few more times, and we can pack the place, Jesus. And those lepers, I know 9 of them didn't come back, Jesus, but one of them, he was charged up about it. You see, his focus was all completely wrong. His focus was the focus of many people today in the church. Let's present a triumphalist Christ. Let's produce a political Christ. Let's produce a psychological guru. Let's tell the world that Jesus is something that he isn't. Jesus, we don't want the crucified stuff. That was Peter. And what did Jesus say to him? He said, "Hey, Peter, get behind me." He didn't actually say Peter. He said, "Satan, get behind me." Because Peter had begun to think the way the world thinks, even though he walked that closely to that Jesus. So let it be a warning to us this morning who live within the orb of the church and believe that simply because we are along the right lines with the right agenda and with the right terminology that somehow or another all of this couldn't apply to us. Let me tell you, it could happen to you in a moment that all of a sudden you've begun to embrace a wisdom which is earthly rather than spiritual and eternal. And it happens to churches. And it happens to congregations, and that's why we could go back through Europe, and we could go into Germany, we could go into Switzerland, we could go into England and Scotland and Ireland and Wales, and we could look today at churches that are totally derelict. And the reason for their dereliction is because men and women refused to acknowledge the implications of 1 Corinthians 1:18 to 25, and it began to embrace the very wisdom that God said he would bring to nothing. And he brings it to nothing. Within the framework of a church building or within the framework of a university establishment such as Harvard or Yale, he will bring it to nothing. He will show its triviality. Now in verse 20, by means of a series of rhetorical questions, Paul essentially asks one question, and this is it. What have the wise man, the scholar, and the philosopher to show for all their wisdom? What have they to show for all their wisdom? Now we might answer that and say, well, they've got quite a lot to show for all their wisdom. Because there is no question that down through the ages, man has made some phenomenal discoveries, amazing inventions. And all of those as a result of God's common grace. But the underlying question is framed within the parameters of perishing or being saved. And what Paul is saying is this: when you take all the wisdom of man, has man in his wisdom been able to deal with that most fundamental issue of our lives, simply the fact of our own destiny, of our own moral perplexity, of our own disinterest in God? And the answer, of course, is man in his wisdom doesn't have very much to show at all. Because man in his wisdom has not been able to bring forgiveness, has not been able to offer peace, has not been able to bring satisfaction to the hungry soul. Those of you who are scholars of history will know that this is the case. In the 1920s, it was a problem of starvation between the Armenians and the Turks. 70 years later, we still got a problem between the Armenians and the Turks. At the turn of the century, from the 19th century into the 20th century in Britain, the notion was that if only we could have better education and better housing and better social services, that man would just be a really fine guy. And the problem is that Britain just couldn't get its act together and be nice to people. And if only it was nice to people, then people would be nice to it. It's kind of like in the words of Paul Simon in his song, Slip Sliding Away. The nearer our destination, the more we're slip sliding away. Because after all, time has gone by, and we're far more educated than our forefathers, right? But we're not any more moral. We have far more resources, but we're not any less selfish. We have mastered the world of communication and with exponential growth develop it every single day, and yet we're not any better at hearing when somebody says something to us. Husbands can't live with their wives. Husbands may take cellular phones and talk on airplanes halfway around the world, but when they get home and their wife speaks to them, they haven't got a clue what's going on. We have better houses, better education, psychological gurus ad nauseum, but what do we face? We face today hatred, strife, conflict, drugs, crime, mental breakdowns, and family disintegration. The complexity of human wisdom promises what it cannot deliver. The simplicity of the gospel makes available what human wisdom can never embrace. I think it was manifest fairly clearly this week in an article that was covered, I think, in most papers. It certainly was on the front of the Plain Dealer. Scientists say skull bone from the first known human. Did you read that? Good stuff. Now, I'm not a scientist, and some of you are, so I've got to be very careful that I don't display the totality of my ignorance. However, as I read this, it really made me laugh, sad, ticked off, and a multitude of emotions. Announcing to us that the earliest known member of the hominid lineage to this point was Australopithecus, which is quite a name to go to bed with, actually has a second name, Australopithecus afarensis, best known from the skeleton called Lucy. Now that's wise, I'll give you that. I mean, if you've got a name called Australopithecus afarensis, and you can call it Lucy, that's a good idea. That is human wisdom working now, okay? Various specimens range in age from just under 4 million years to about 2.5 million years, and though Australopithecus walked on two legs, its brain size was about that of a chimpanzee. So I say, what else is new? After all, some of you are school teachers, right? And you are dealing with these Australopithecus types. I mean, they're going to be sitting out there tomorrow, walking on two legs and with a brain the size of a chimpanzee. But the thing that underlies the article is this, that all of a sudden, scientists have determined that this find in Kenya pushes back the known emergence of the first true human beings by 500,000 years. I mean, what's 500,000 years between friends, you see? Woo! We just altered things by 500,000 years. They got a major problem because now they got monkeys and men at the same time, and they can't have monkeys and men at the same time. Have you seen that? Because they determined that monkeys and men were not around at the same time. And since monkeys and men were not around at the same time, they can't be around at the same time, so we got to fiddle this some way again to prove in the wisdom which God will bring to nothing and in the intelligence which God will frustrate that we've actually got it right and display again the words of the psalmist, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Listen, let me tell you, youngsters, as you go back to school tomorrow, don't you make a nuisance to yourself. Don't you be a bad person. Don't you ever be rude to your science teacher. But don't you ever let them drive you into a corner and tell you that you are an idiot because you actually believe that the Bible is true when it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay? Because these folks do not have the answers. They do not. The eruption in Mount St. Helens has driven evolutionary scientists absolutely bonkers. Because for the last 50 years they have been maintaining that certain things in a landmass could never be present without the passage of millions and millions of years. And since the eruption of Mount St. Helens, the reappearance of vegetation, the discovery of petrified wood, and quality coal has happened in such a short period of time that either the scientists must admit that their theory of dating and their original thinking is inaccurate, or else they're going to have to jump around. Make no mistake. The combination of foolish thinking as it related to Bultmann throwing out the truth of the Bible in Germany, and the emergence of Darwin saying, since there is no God, we better have a substitute, is the process which has degenerated to the point at which we live today. Now, I'm only about a third of the way into what I want to say, but our time has gone. Paul is going to go on to say, and we'll come back to this, that God hasn't just disregarded human wisdom, he's made it foolish. And he's going to come back, and we will come back and emphasize again that yes, our neighbors and our friends, while being prepared to embrace religion, while being willing perhaps to say, we'd like to consider these things, the real stickler for them is the notion of the cross of Jesus Christ. That on a Judean hillside, the bloodied back of a beaten man who had done nothing other than take children on his lap and love them, take dead men and raise them to life, take blind and make them see, take lame and make them walk, challenge religious hypocrisy to its core, that there in the bloodied open wounds of that man is the very destiny of humanity explained. To the world 2,000 years on from Paul's day, it remains absolute nonsense. And the question for the believer is, are you prepared to be thought a fool for Jesus' sake? And the question to the unbeliever is, are you prepared to bow your knee and bow your will and say in wonder, can it be that I should gain an interest in the Savior's blood? Did he die for me who caused his pain? For me who by my going in darkened rooms sinned and abused him and abused myself and my loved ones? Did he die for me? Amazing love. How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? That is the gospel. Nothing less than that is the gospel, and nothing more than that is the gospel. It is a very disreputable, unrespectable, unapparently intellectual proclamation. But it was Paul's preaching, and it is to be our preaching. Let us pause in a moment of prayer. And as you pause in a moment of silence, and as we prepare to respond in song to the focus on the cross, which has been our direction this morning, just ask yourself, where am I in relation to this continuum? Am I perishing, or am I being saved? If you're being saved, then humility ought to reveal itself in our lives in a zeal for evangelism. And if we're perishing, nothing that I can say, nor any coercive influence of anybody else, is going to get you out of that condition. The only change that ever may be brought about is as a result of God calling you in your heart, speaking to you and saying, you want a sign? The sign is on the cross. You want wisdom? It's in the cross. You want forgiveness? It's in the cross. And right where you are this morning, without anybody interfering in your life, you can ask God to forgive your sin, to fill your life with His blessing and His power, and you may go out from here in the ranks of those who are being saved, no longer in the ranks of the perishing. Father, hear the cries which come from our hearts this morning. For Jesus' sake we ask it. Amen.
That concludes this message. Thanks for listening to Truth for Life. If you'd like information on ordering additional messages from Alistair Begg and Truth for Life, then call our resource line at 1-888-58-TRUTH. Write to us at Post Office Box 39-8000, Cleveland, Ohio 44139, or visit us online at truthforlife.org. Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.